You're listening to the Table Talk podcast, brought to you by the team at Food Matters. Welcome. In these podcasts, we chat with visionaries from across the food industry to discover the ideas that will shape our future. I'm Stephen Gates, a food science writer, TV presenter, and gastronaut. Today, we're asking, is it the end for British food standards? Last month, ministers rejected amendments in the trade bill in a move that would allow them to approve the import of animal and agricultural products of a lower standard than those that are currently permitted in the UK. Now, these changes might seem small, but their impact could be huge. Now, previously a bastion for animal welfare standards and high quality products, will the UK now be at the whim of other nations? Not so stringent regulations. What are the far-reaching implications of the bill on British produce, farming, animal welfare, the environment and public health? A lot to discuss here there. And to join us to discuss this are David Baldock, Senior Fellow, Institute for European Environmental Policy.
Hello.
Anna Sands, Trade Policy Specialist, Worldwide Fund for Nature UK.
Hello.
Sophie Medlin, Director and Specialist Dietitian, City Dietitians.
Hello.
And Liz Webster, Founder, Save British Farming.
Hello.
Right, let's get deep into this. Anna, you are the trade policy specialist. How could trade deals lead to the lowering of UK environmental and agricultural standards?
Bear with me because there's a few different steps here. But basically, we've heard from government that they will not compromise on food and environmental standards in trade. Well, that's one thing, but when negotiating trade deals, they will have to agree whether they accept food products from other countries, such as, say, Australia or the US, to be sold in the UK. And if they do accept them, will they accept them with the same kinds of standards that we have in the UK, or will they accept them with the standards that they have in those countries? So if a free trade deal allows import of such products that have, a lower standard than those in the UK, what we might have is that we'll have UK farmers competing with foreign producers, creating products which don't require them to follow certain standards. And so we'll have competitive pressure on UK farmers. And that in the end might lead to those farmers or other groups asking for lowering British standards to allow them more of a fair playing field or level playing field with the foreign products.
Now, would you say, Anna, that the current arrangements are insufficient? As we stand at the moment, do we not have the mechanisms to protect our environmental and agricultural standards?
So what's interesting here is that while we've retained EU law on many of these standards, this law is now very easy to change by ministers because they are able to do so through so-called secondary legislation. So that means that it doesn't have to go through Parliament, and MPs don't really have a say on how these standards might change. And where this is especially important is when trade deals get negotiated, because if a trade deal would lead to the import of certain types of products, and to do that, ministers can then change the law to allow it, Parliament would not have a say either at the stage at which these standards are changed or at the stage when a trade agreement is agreed. And here is where we might come to discussing the trade bill, because that's what might potentially give parliamentarians more of a say on the trade agreements themselves.
Now, David, the trade bill went back to the Lords yesterday. That's the 2nd of February. They were trying to get amendments in there. What happened? What do you think is likely to be the result of all of this?
The Lords have been very much pressing for a say for Parliament in deals, both before the negotiating terms are set by the British government and once the deal has been negotiated. And that's a very good idea. Unfortunately, when the Lords have supported amendments, which have been supported widely by all sorts of public interest groups in the UK, from farmers to environmentalists to public health specialists, the government has chucked out these amendments once they reach the House of Commons. We have this thing called ping pong, where the amendments go back and forth between the two houses of Parliament. So at the moment, it seems that although the Lords have really been upholding this principle pretty consistently, we expect the commons to throw them out again, and therefore that they won't prevail.
What the hell's going on here? I mean, I'm sure I remember comments from ministers saying that there would not be a watering down of standards.
Yes, indeed, they said that. And of course, the trade bill in itself doesn't alter standards. It just sets the terms, if you like, on which the UK negotiates with other countries. But as Anna says, the difficulty is that once you start negotiating with a country like the US, which has significantly lower standards in a number of areas, for example, in farm animal welfare, the pressure comes on to accept imports from the US and to accept them at a lower standard. And the UK, therefore, could buckle to this pressure. While we were in the EU, this is very unlikely to happen because the EU didn't buckle under such pressure and didn't have a philosophy which was particularly tempted to do so. Now we've got a government which does include quite a few people who think free trade is a good thing, with rather little fettering and controls, and the UK is not such a powerful player as the EU, so it's more vulnerable to pressure and trade deals.
And basically, the UK government really is now desperate to make new trade deals, and therefore the likelihood is that something's going to give.
That's the big fear, exactly. And it's just started 2 days ago on a new negotiation to join the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And again, there are countries in that which don't have such high standards relating to food as the UK does.
Sophie, let's move on a little bit to the concept of how good this food is for us. Now, everyone's talked about chlorinated chicken. Now, I see chlorinated chicken as a symbol. It's symbolic of a range of other lowered standards. Would you agree?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the key thing to remember is that they bleach the chicken in the factories because the standards within the factories, the food standards, are really low. So that's something that we don't permit in this country. We insist on high standards within factories so that our food doesn't have to be bleached before we eat it. And that, to me, sounds like something we should maintain and something that's important. The thing to remember about all of the changes that are likely to come in, or the things that we're likely to see on our shelves that we don't currently see, is that we're talking about a range of practices and also ingredients that the EU have banned for a reason.
Can you give some examples of those things? So we've got chlorinated chicken. What other aspects are there alongside that could pose some level of health concern?
So antibiotic use in farming is much heavier-handed in other countries, particularly the US. And we know from human studies that antibiotic use in agriculture does translate into antibiotic resistance in humans. The UK has very high standards of having very low antibiotic use within our farming, better than some other parts of the EU. So we're in a very privileged position. And there's been a lot of work over the last 20 years or so within the field of medicine to reduce antibiotic resistance. And so to now reintroduce antibiotic meat that's been treated with antibiotics is a real shame and could put us all at higher risk. The reason antibiotics are used within the food chain in the US and within farming so heavily is because farming standards, animal welfare standards, are much lower. And so the animals are at much higher risk of infections and things like that. And so antibiotics are used as a preventative measure, which is not allowed in this country. The farmers are held to high standards of animal welfare, which means that antibiotic use is less required, which then means we don't have as much antibiotics in the food chain, which translates to us all having healthier resistance to bacterial infections and things like that. So we enjoy that high standard, which will be potentially lost should this all go through. Another thing is that the US approved the use of various different pesticides and additives into food that aren't allowed through the EU legislation. And that's because the EU took a slightly different approach to regulating these things. So whereas the US said it's probably okay, the EU said we're not sure if it's okay, so it's a no on basic terms. So we're not talking about small level changes. We're not talking about things that are inconsequential. Ultimately, we're talking about putting people at much higher risk, or certainly at higher risk of various different health problems.
A cynic would probably say, well, look, Americans aren't all dead. They're still alive. Therefore, what can the problem be? But the reality is there is an extraordinarily high level of foodborne illness in the US, isn't there? I believe there's 128,000 1,000 people are hospitalized every year in the US. 48 million get sick from foodborne illnesses. The amounts are much higher in the US. This is not just a little niggle. It's an important aspect. There is a fundamentally different approach here, isn't there? The EU uses the sort of precautionary principle where you say nothing's allowed until it's proven to be safe. It's almost the opposite is true in the US, where the impetus is on science to prove that something's wrong.
Yeah, absolutely. So they do take a different approach, and they do recommend, so the US has much lower standards in terms of, well, we assume this is safe and therefore we're going to allow it into the food chain. The foodborne illness story is really, really important. And, you know, in this country, we've virtually eradicated salmonella from the world. But that is something that still crops up regularly and causes regular deaths in the US because salmonella food poisoning is deadly. And for that to start cropping up again in our care homes, in those who are most vulnerable from school meals and all this sort of stuff, would be really problematic.
Mm. I'd really like to move on to Liz. Now, Liz, you are the founder of Save British Farming. What does this mean for farmers?
When you look at what the changes that they're making for farming, in that they're removing subsidies to produce food, and they're turning us into environmentalists. So park keepers is what I like to call it. And they're very clear that they want 30% of the country to be rewilded, which is just sounds, to me, it's sort of like something out of Wind in the Willows, you know, everything's going to be so beautiful and just go back to nature. And it sounds lovely, but I was born in the 60s. My parents and grandparents drummed into me what it was like not having any food during the war. I think it's just cataclysmic to lose our food security, but inevitably that is at risk. So I think what you'll find, the only way for farmers to farm, because farmers are addicted to farming food, so they will still continue to farm food, but the only way for them to make money with the removal of subsidy and with the foreign competition, which is of a lower standard and also produced in better conditions, better weather, with more land. So what you will find is that the only way to produce food will be to intensify for the general market. And then at the other end of the spectrum, you will find that the quality premium market will really flourish. So because the wealthy people will pay more to avoid the bad food. And indeed, it is really here already. We already have mass-produced chicken houses. There are American interests in those chicken houses. We've got the same going with beef. I don't know if it'll ever come here that we will use hormones in the same way that Australia and America does. I mean, I suppose it probably is inevitable because, you know, once you start breaking a barrier, then that's probably what it'll lead to.
And at the same time, we've just had the agriculture bill through, and then we're looking at the trade bill. It seems as those two things don't seem to match up. As you say, the agriculture bill is really trying to turn farmers into environmentalists. The trade bill seems to be allowing the government to drop the concept of standards, which would presumably include those environmental standards.
So I think there is a drive to make everything seem lovely here. And we're just exporting, we're just exporting the mass production and it'll come in from, you know, from South America, Australia, New Zealand, and increase the food miles. It probably breaches the Paris Climate Agreement. But the one thing to remember is I don't think we'll be getting an American trade deal anytime soon. I think it'll take some time, if it happens, to join the CPTPP. The Australian deal might come through and the New Zealand deal, but if they deregulate, if they diverge for those two trade deals, then we lose the trade deal with the European Union. So they are in quite a tricky balance at the moment.
David, what impact do you think all of this will have on the environment?
Well, if standards are lowered, what we're concerned about is there could be multiple impacts. For example, if we find that standards for pesticides are lowered because countries which we're importing food from have much more liberal standards on pesticides, and therefore there's pressure to allow a wider range of pesticides in the UK, and we've seen some indications this might happen already, then we could get more wide use of those pesticide impacts on different types of fauna and flora, on pollinators, including bees, for example. If we find that we're getting large-scale exports of, let's say, pigs from the US, where production costs, 20-25% lower, probably, it varies, and then British farmers are saying, well, we don't want to have to meet the same standards of water protection as we've got now. In the US, you get a lot of water pollution associated with pig production, for example. Then there could be pressure to roll back standards, for example, which control the use of nitrates and the pollution of drinking water from nitrates, which has health as well as environmental implications. And we could see also some pressure on measures to protect habitats, because those can be quite constraining on farms. If you're on a farm which has areas of relatively natural habitats, wetlands, hedges, woodland, and so forth, if you want to absolutely maximize your production, there could be pressures on that as well. Depends, obviously, how the standards play out and what exactly happens, but so it could go in different directions like that.
Anna, we have the 2021 United Nations Climate Change Conference coming to Glasgow this November. Surely we should be taking a lead on environmental issues, certainly in relation to food standards. Do you think that there is a moral imperative here for us?
Yes, I think so, definitely. I think all the eyes are set on the UK at the moment in the lead up to COP26. And then definitely setting out how to address this problem of imports of a lower standard. And one way of doing that would be to introduce some form of environmental standards that apply to both products in the UK and abroad. And I think that would be something that might address some of the concerns that Liz was expressing with having a very uneven market for domestic and for foreign farmers, and for finding a way that's not just a sort of exporting our production to other countries, but actually creating a sort of better market for environmentally well-produced food products overall.
Now, I'd like to bring up something that's a little counterintuitive, I would hope. It's the concept of cheap food. Now, whenever it's talked about in the media, cheap food is seen as something negative. It's cheap food is a snide phrase. But isn't it a double-edged sword? We're looking at the socioeconomic impact of food poverty, child poverty. They've all increased substantially. How does it relate? Is there an ambiguity, a moral ambiguity, when it comes to looking at how much a person can afford for the basic food? And Sophie, this is a question for you, really. Lower standards, cheaper food, isn't it?
So, yeah, lower standards could mean cheaper foods, but that will mean that those who can least afford the health inequality, sort of the health gap between rich and poor, to get even wider. The chances are that these cheaper food imports will go straight into chicken shops in poorer areas. They'll go into fast food outlets. They'll go into schools and prisons and care homes and those kinds of organisations that can't afford to make better decisions. And people in the House of Commons, people in government and their friends and the people that they socialise with will benefit from being able to afford to make a different decision. And I would argue that nobody would choose for their child, for example, to have a diet of antibiotic-treated meat, hormone-treated meat, these kinds of higher food risk from food poisoning, all that kind of stuff. If that's not what the government would choose for themselves, to me, there is a hugely moral problem with them choosing that for poorer people. Unfortunately, in this country, we do have a really shameful gap between the health that the rich people enjoy and the health that the poor people do not enjoy, and the standards that people enjoy, and that will inevitably become increasingly wider should we allow this to go through and for these kind of issues that we're going to invite into our food chain if that happens. no one is looking at the American health, of the health of the American people, and thinking that's what we want for the UK. They may not be dropping dead, but we definitely don't want to mimic their health outcomes. They are far worse than us in non-communicable diseases.
And also the concept of 3,000 people dying from foodborne illness kind of masks the impact of the millions of people who suffer from foodborne illness that doesn't kill. And that impact is like an iceberg, isn't it? The vast amount of people, you know, bubbling under the surface who suffer from these things.
Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, young children are very vulnerable to infectious. So young children are very vulnerable to gastrointestinal infections, as are the elderly. And the majority of us in between would survive, but would inevitably have a very unpleasant time. And, you know, I see a lot of patients in my clinic who've got horrible, ongoing, irritable bowel syndrome as a result of a brief bout of gastrointestinal problems as a result of food poisoning.
If we look outside the UK for a second, so we've been talking about the socioeconomic impact of that would happen here. David, if we look at the global food system, if we change the parameters within which a deal can be done, does this not provide more opportunity for trade with developing countries who are desperate for and would benefit from that trade?
That's very much an argument used in favour of trade liberalisation to reduce the barriers to imports from developing countries, poorer countries across the world. I think that can be a bit misleading, though, because in some cases, these countries are not particularly competitive. The production is very often considerably cheaper from countries like the US and Australia, especially of livestock products, where we've got many of the issues we're particularly concerned with do originate from trade in livestock, whereas a lot of developing countries are exporting fruit, vegetables, commodities like that, where there's certainly environmental concerns, but often they're not as acute and in many cases not so competitive with products from the UK. And we do have some concerns about trade liberalisation, for example, where it's resulting in large-scale imports from parts of the world where they're deforesting land to increase production of soya or cattle, for example, in parts of Latin America and in parts of Indonesia. So I think the issue with developing countries is quite a complicated one. So it's definitely not a reason, I don't think, to lower standards in the UK to fight against poverty in the rest of the world.
Now, Liz, is there another way to achieve this? If we see the passing of this trade bill as relatively inevitable, couldn't there be a groundswell of UK farmers teaming up to sell their produce on the basis of it being a better environmentally, better, you know, it's a premium product, and that would keep the momentum of what you've achieved over so many years going?
Well, certainly there is a desire for that to happen. And interestingly, in Scotland and in Wales, there is much greater political support to reintroduce more local slaughterhouses and almost decentralise the food system, because that would enable this kind of arrangement. And really the big change will be a political change when we get to a general election. If people want to, to get off this trajectory that we're on at the moment, is to really vote with a party that has that vision, because for me, I can't think of anything better. It is, celebrating being British and keeping everything, as possible, intact as possible for our food security and for our environment. But that's what most farmers would love to see: more sustainability, less food miles, people eating more different varieties of British apples and, the rest of it, eating more food that's in season. All of those things buys into the whole, fighting climate change and everything else. So let's hope that's what happens.
it's a weakness. It leads us to environmental degradation and the inability in the future to be able to supply the food that we need without just completely ruining the environment. I mean, it's not just about cash. It's about a physical manifestation of our ability to feed ourselves, isn't it?
Well, for me, yeah, it destroys Britain as we know it. It makes me want to cry. You know, I mean, how many times do you go away to a hot country and when you fly back in and you see the beautiful green tapestry of Britain? And that will be changed irrevocably if we end up in this awful trade deal with America. There's no doubt about that. You know, all of that will go. The reason that people voted for Brexit is to hold on to that, not to lose it. I don't think anyone voted to turn into what we all know America is, where you have areas that are no-go zones, where you have intensive farming, which is ghastly.
Change is afoot, whether we like it or not. There's the trade bill going through. There's a lot of change that's going to happen and unfold over the coming months. What would you like to see happen, and how might that happen?
Sure. I think the key thing right now is to ensure that we have an insight into what goes into trade deals in the future and are able to shape them. And all of the sort of public work of writing to MPs will only be effective if we then have MPs have an influence on trade deals. So we all want to ensure that that takes place. And for that, we need MPs to vote for these amendments to the trade bill next week. So there's definitely an important place to influence there. We need people to write to their MPs to say that they want them to support the amendment for more scrutiny. And then to follow that, once hopefully we have a more transparent, more secure process, I think we need to have a public consultation and a big conversation on the next trade deals that are coming. So the Australian trade deal, which some of you have mentioned today, is also puts us at a lot of risk of imports of low standard food. We have to make sure that they're not passed behind closed doors without either the public or our MPs having a say on these deals.
In terms of the more legal and political steps, the government needs to go beyond its sort of broad statements of supporting standards and make it absolutely clear it won't water these down in future. And one way to do that is to put into law a non-regression commitment, non-regression in the sense that standards will not be weakened over time. And it got quite close to such a provision in the trade deal with the EU, but didn't quite go that far in the end.
We are at Save British Farming about to set up what we're calling a pledge campaign to get the public to see if their MPs will sign a pledge to say they won't vote for any trade deals which compromise our standards. I think it's certainly worth putting a push behind this because we know from polling that between 90 and 94% of people don't want lower standards. And you know, we've done a spectacular job in communicating how bad this is for Britain. It is absolutely worth fighting for because I think it goes against British values, which are animal welfare, the environment, our health. So really it's up for us smaller organisations to you know, really take the lead.
I think that the MPs who are making the choices for us need to be held accountable for their actions, and they need to be held accountable for the decisions that they make. We will remember the names of the MPs who make these decisions in years to come as we see the consequences of their choices borne out in our most vulnerable in society. And so writing to your MP, I think, is really important and could be really valuable and potentially be the thing that highlights the fact that we do see what they're doing and we do care about these decisions that are made. Even if you feel that you'll be in the position of privilege of not having these things affect your diet directly, they will inevitably get into the food chain and be in various different places. Some supermarkets have said that they won't stock imported meat, but they can't guarantee it won't be in their processed meat products. So things like chicken burgers and what have you. So it will affect you as an individual. Please do consider writing to MP and tell people about what's going on as well, because word of mouth can be really powerful in these things.
Well, thank you so much, all of you, for joining us. I mean, it takes a lot of effort to achieve high standards. I fear that losing them is very easy and would happen very quickly. So I think we really need to ring fence what we've achieved so much so far and what our farmers have done. David, Anna, Sophie and Liz, thank you so much for joining us today. It has been absolutely fascinating. I really look forward to picking this up again with you in the near future if possible. You've been listening to the Tabletop Podcast brought to you by Food Matters, and you heard from Liz Webster, Sophie Medlin, Anna Sands and David Baldock and me, Stefan Gates. Thank you all very much. If you enjoyed this episode, you might like one of our other podcasts in which we explore pretty much every aspect of the food industry, from salmon farm sustainability to apprenticeships. Subscribe to get every episode freshly delivered to you on Apple, Spotify, Google or your preferred podcasting platform. And to find out more, take a look at foodmatters.co.uk. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to the Tabletop Podcast, brought to you by Food Matters. Subscribe to get every episode freshly delivered on Apple, Spotify, Google, or your preferred podcasting platform. And to find out more, please visit foodmatters.co.uk.